Okay. Good afternoon. And so, there was a request for a description of the preparation for meditation, which is a very reasonable request. I have imposed upon Matthew to ask him to give that instruction to you. You don't need mine. Okay. This can where people can see you.
So this is a question about the preliminaries that Chula Dasa teaches before you begin to meditate. And the person says, it seems appropriate. Can you mention the 5 preliminary steps and the 4 other things as ways to prepare our minds for meditation session after we leave this lovely retreat? P.S. Can we stay 1 more week? So I'll go through them quickly so that Chula Dasa can get onto the other questions. So the preliminaries are very helpful, especially if you're moving from your kind of hectic everyday world to the meditation. And the 5 preliminaries, there are actually 6 steps, and it's almost like an analytic meditation. I'll go through the 6, and then there's the 4-step process to move to the meditation object. So the first preliminary, the first piece is setting your big goal. Why are you sitting down? I want to become enlightened. I want more peace of mind. It doesn't matter really. It can be anything. Anything that's motivating you personally. What's your bringing you to the cushion? So put that intention in your mind when you sit down. The second thing is setting your specific intention for this particular practice. What are you going to work on? I'm going to work on stability of attention. I'm going to make sure my awareness is open. If I slip into dullness, I'm going to apply the appropriate antidotes. So you go through that stage as well. So big goal, specific intention. Once you set your specific intention, remind yourself the 3rd step, to be happy no matter what happens. Okay. So if you, it doesn't matter, the only bad sit is the sit you didn't do. And I can't remember who the meditation teacher's name is who said that, but it's important to, once you set your goal, your specific goal, that no matter what happens, if you've been mind-wandering the whole time, at the completion, just remind yourself that you are happy that you just spent that time to practice. Really, that's part of that positive encouragement that's so critical in this practice. The 4th step is to have diligence, do the practice, work on it. If some brilliant insight comes along or some interesting mind wandering goes on, be diligent and make a commitment to bringing yourself back to the practice. That's 4. The 5th is do a quick scan of your mind, especially if you're in the hectic daily life that you face and there's things that are going to bother you. Well, what's going on in your mind? Are things going to come up, in this meditation session? Is your mind particularly agitated? Is it particularly dull? So just take a quick look inside and know if something in particular volatile or is going to come up, commit to acknowledging it, allowing it, and letting it go. And then 6, actually, after you've done all that, you do some final adjustments on your posture. Okay. And you can do this while you're sitting. You can do it on your walk to your cushion. It's up to you. And am I right so far?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is it you that think I'm nervous? I do this for a profession, but usually the teacher's not in the room. So then the four steps to progress to the meditation. So once you're sitting down, you've gone through the preliminary, sit down. And the first step or stage is have your awareness and attention open and free. And this is to transition you to the kind of spontaneous movements of attention of daily life to the intentional movements. So at that first step or the 4th step, you have completely open awareness and attention. You can let your attention go to a sound in the room. You can let your attention go to some part of your body. You can let your attention even go to thoughts, although thoughts are tricky because they quickly drag you into the future and the past. So the only restriction on your attention in this first step is it has to be in the present moment. So that's the first, open awareness, free-floating attention. Then you transition to the body. So your attention is on any sensations, specifically on the body, and you are also highlighting any pleasurable sensations, anything that feels particularly good. Always evoking feelings of relaxation, feelings of contentment, feelings of pleasure, feelings of joy. Priming the mind, really. And if you find some part on your body that's particularly pleasurable or a sensation you're enjoying, take time to enjoy it and see how it tunes up the mind. Then the third step is to the breath-related sensations, restricting it just to the rise and fall of the abdomen, the chest, the air hitting the back of the nose, the back of the throat. And then the last step is to your meditation object. And just when you thought you could start meditating, there's then the 10 count, if you want. To stabilize your... I do it consistently. I do that. And how long this takes you, by the way, is up to you. It's different for every person. How long you go from wide open awareness and attention down to the breath will change from... can take you the whole... If you're beginning, it can take you the whole session. If you're finding that your mind is agitated, I sometimes jump all the way to state 2. If that's not working, I'll go back to 4. So you can play with it, right? And then once I'm finally on the object, I'll do a 10 count.
Okay. Thank you. I could not have put it better myself. Okay. Thank you very much for that, Matthew. A lot of questions here. I'll try to go through all of them. I don't know if I'll succeed. A couple of people have asked about the draft copy of the book. Just to clarify that, okay? I can't make copies of it available until the publisher has a final draft. It is said at that point I can make PDF copies available. He didn't, to my students, he didn't say himself how my students were defined. So that either means it's up to me to decide. Or else, well, no. What it means is, I'd like for that to be for it to be up to me, but I probably should check to make sure. When you say that, are you envisioning that I'm going to make copies available to 10 people or 1,000? Once I find that out, then I'll be able to answer this other question about: are all the people at this retreat considered your students? Well, most definitely to me. But on the other hand, if the editor at Wisdom says, no, I'm not, like a dozen, then I'm going to have to figure out how to deal with that. So, but it's not going to happen right away, okay? It's only when it's ready. Yeah?
The handout we all received here, the 24-page,
yeah.
Can we copy that and share that with friends?
Yes, you can. You certainly can. And there are some other writings on the website that, of course, they're freely available.
So this version we have is on your website as a PDF?
What's that?
The version we have of the steps to meditation are on the website now.
There is a brief version similar to the ones that you have that's on the website. I periodically make changes to it, so it may not be exactly the same. Okay. And somehow or another amongst us all, we'll stay in communication. And so when the time comes and I know who I can make it available to, when the time comes, I'll have to probably go to Jesse or somebody else like that to get an updated list of people's emails. It's not even updated. There's a lot of people I don't. But some of you I have contact information from, either from last year's retreat or from questionnaires you did this year. But there's some people that I just don't have that information from. So don't worry about it for the time being. When the time comes, that will be a priority to sort out. Okay? All right. Here's one I really like. So there are many others who would like to help you realize your vision, could you please let us know what you need, besides us practicing and awakening and then teaching. Projects, worldly skillful goals, designing visual handouts, so forth. Yeah, I really, that kind of help is fabulous. One person has volunteered to help with visual aids, things that could be converted into PowerPoint slides. And anybody else that would like to do, who has that kind of skill and would like to do that, that would be welcome as well. Have a view to creating maybe a library of PowerPoint slides that as people begin to teach, you know, then they can freely make use of those. And as is becoming more and more obvious with every retreat, every teaching session I do, they absolutely need to have visual aids. So that's something that's useful. There's a huge amount of material that has been recorded. And, you know, it gets recorded and it's wonderful because it's there and people can access it, but there's a certain point where there's so much that it kind of disappears. Right? It gets lost amongst itself. There is one person here, didn't speak to her yet, but she communicated to me through Jesse that she would be interested in helping to catalog the recorded material. Cataloging, transcribing, just simply the ones you listen to, writing a brief description of to make it easier for other people to know what a particular talk is about, all the way up to someone who has the interest and the writing skills who would like to collaborate with me by taking a topic that they're really interested in and writing a booklet, a pamphlet, something like that, that we could collaborate on. So to make information more readily available, that's another thing that would be very useful. Okay? And I'm sure there's all kinds of other things that I'm not going to be able to think of. If you have technical skills, I don't. I used to be a technical person, but there's something that happens with the passage of time. the technology outruns us, and you know it's like one of those things that once you've missed a step, you never quite catch up. And I missed a few steps, and so if you have skills in the area of technology, and you see that there's something that could definitely be improved, and that you're willing to do it and interested in doing it. What I don't need is people to say, well, you know what you really should do? What I'm going to hear is, I think I could help you by doing this for you. Right? And if so, yeah, it would be enormously appreciated. So I don't know who wrote the note, but to all of you who are in tune with what they said, I thank you very much, and I look forward to it. Yeah.
Do you have an administrator, or so like how can you go about like organizing? And
okay. Well,
someone who
we have Dharma Treasure has a board with about a dozen people on it, and we're not very old. And they're busy really trying to do a lot of things, the basic things that are necessary with the organization. One thing that we don't really have at the moment is sort of a person who is mainly in charge of the administrative aspect. And that's something that we could really, really use. I mean, I have an offer from somebody who is very talented who would like to basically become the CEO. But they can't do that until there is... we need to be able to pay them some kind of a salary and give them health care, right? So in the meantime, not just in the meantime, but certainly in the meantime, any kinds of administrative skills and the sorts of things that used to be you could only do if you know, you were in the same physical location. Now, with all of this fabulous technology, there's a lot of administrative things that could be carried out from halfway across the continent. So that's definitely an area we could use help with. Fundraising for the specific project of being able to employ a person as a full-time CEO to organize all of this, create teaching program, teacher training program, all this kind of stuff. That's something that people could do. If you are a fundraiser par excellence and you're looking for some place other than a local children's hospital to put your skills in. And then, you know, a lot of administrative help. As a matter of fact, I am not an administrator. It's not my thing. And I have people come to me and say, can I help? And I feel like I want to go hide because, I need all kinds of help, but I don't know how to tell you what to do. Even somebody that could just, you know, get a clear picture of what the needs are and be able to channel other people's energy into it. I love the idea that you share my vision. My vision is a world where instead of being driven by desire and aversion and ignorance, that we have a we have an entire society that comes from a place of love and kindness and compassion and wisdom, and that is structured so that these values are transmitted to our children at a very early age and reinforced through public media and public school and everything else, rather than that it is as it is now. The child reaches the age where, for the first time, it occurs to grab something and say, mine. It gets reinforced then throughout the rest of your life, everything you see and hear thereafter. Yeah. I'll welcome anything that you have to offer. Okay. Last year, you briefly mentioned using biofeedback training with some of your meditators. Could you speak more about that? Are you aware of any biofeedback devices or software that might be used in connection with your training on the 10 level? Very briefly, there's a system, it's called Zengar, it's called, if you were to Google Zengar, you'd find it. It is a really fabulous biofeedback system. It really helps to... It trains your brain to work more efficiently. And the result of that is it helps to accelerate you through that most drawn-out period of the first few stages of meditation, where there is the greatest disturbance. It's an expensive system. It costs about $10,000. It operates on a PC. But it's very powerful. It's very easy to use. And if anybody is interested in following up on that further, we have one in Arizona. We've used it with a lot of meditators. So anybody that wants to follow it up further, you can talk to me, you can talk to Nancy. And it would be, I believe, a really powerful adjunct to not just your meditation practice, but meditation training in general. It helps many things.
How did you spell it? Zengar?
Zengar, Z-E-N-G-A-R.
G-A-R.
Yeah. And it's interesting, it works different than every other biofeedback or neurofeedback system. The information from the EEG electrodes is analyzed to detect signs of turbulence in the electrical activity of the brain. In a dynamic system, turbulence builds up and then a phase shift takes place. And then it'll be stable for a while and then turbulence builds up till another phase shift takes place. What the system does is so incredibly simple. Through feedback, it tells your brain at an unconscious level, well, it's conscious, but it does the work at the unconscious level. It communicates at an unconscious level that you're entering into a state of increased turbulence. So the brain gets to decide, you know, do I want to change state or do I not? And that's all it does. And it gives your brain an opportunity to exercise a control over its ongoing activity in a way that doesn't otherwise exist. And the result is your brain works a lot better. So, another question about working with dullness. I'm not able to stand up without really disturbing others around me, but I can seem to manage not to get sleepy once I feel dullness coming on if I open my eyes. Sometimes I have to open them wide. Is this an okay strategy if it's working? Absolutely, absolutely. I talk quickly and sometimes things don't come across the way I think they would. Opening your eyes, if that's the example of a mild antidote for dullness, you know, much milder than standing up. And if that works, that's all you need to do. That's a really good thing to do. It's a wonderful thing to do. I wasn't suggesting you should stand up unless really you already tried the other simpler ways of arousing yourself and they didn't work. And so if you find that you're still sinking into dullness, then standing up. That, standing up is, it's kind of in the extreme category. Not that there's anything wrong with standing up every time you feel dullness. But you don't need to, okay? Also, is it possible that even with great physical fatigue, one can meditate and not get dull or sleepy? To the first part, can you do it without not getting dull? Not really. Fatigue, you can do it without getting sleepy, unless of course the fatigue is too serious. When you are physically ill or severely fatigued, you're going to experience dullness. That doesn't mean that you can't practice, and that doesn't even mean that you can't do practices at some of the more advanced stages. If you are an adept meditator, say 8 through 10, you can be extremely fatigued and you can still do a high level of practice even though the energy level of your mind and the state of clarity that you're operating with is really quite low. But because of the training that's got you to where you are, you can sustain it at, or you can find that level that you can sustain your consciousness at, and you can do certain kinds of work there. I mean, it's obviously not going to be the same as when you're fully alert. But you can't, there's no way, at least to my knowledge, there's no magical point at which you reach that no matter how sick or exhausted you are, that you could move into a state of full, bright alertness. Wish that there was. I wish that there was, but there are physiological limitations. Can you briefly describe the area in which to focus in stage 6 to start developing single-pointedness? And the relationship with experiencing the whole body with the breath. In stage 6, when you want to develop that exclusive focus and single-pointedness, the sensations of the breath at the nose are still, you know, that's something you can work with. You don't need to go anywhere different. On the other hand, by going to experiencing the whole body with the breath, you can make the process much simpler and it greatly accelerates it, because when you are experiencing the whole body with the breath, it requires so much of your total conscious capacity that there's nothing left over for distractions. And the secret in stage 6 of overcoming subtle distractions is that you ignore them so completely for so long that they fade. They cease to be there at all, so you have no more subtle distraction. And in the process of experiencing the whole body with the breath, that one particular kind of distraction, which has always been the worst, which is thoughts, mental objects, memories, emotions, they will actually not only cease to be distractions, they'll also tend to disappear from awareness as well, or at least be there much, much less frequently and stay entirely in awareness where they belong. But you can achieve that just by keeping the focus of your attention on the breath of the nose and very, very diligently exercising the skills you've acquired up to this point to totally ignore those distractions until they fade completely into the background of awareness. You can. It's just so much easier if you shift to the whole body with the breath. Now, when you're using the whole body as your meditation object, that might not fit with what you ordinarily think of as single-pointed. How am I single-pointed on the whole body? But the point of single-pointed isn't how big the object of meditation is. It's that it's the only object of attention. Attention is not alternating with other distractions. So single-pointed really is, if attention is on a single point, it means it's not alternating. If attention is not alternating, it means there are no subtle distractions. So there are two different ways of saying the same thing. Okay? So you can use the whole body as a meditation object, and because it is such a big scope, it just makes it easier to starve those distractions by ignoring them and have them fade away. Okay? If afflictions arise during silent group meditation due to the chronic coughing and throat clearing of a retreatant who is struggling with a bad cold and another who is snoring during the sitting, is it okay to switch from breath counting to metta prayers for these two folk? Well, absolutely. You know, the problem in this case is the affliction, right? It's not the coughing. Now, if it was just the coughing that was the problem, coughing keeps you, I could say, well, meditate on the coughing. Although the coughing might be too intermittent, and then you find yourself afflicted by, can't this person cough? But if you recognize that the real problem is not the coughing, it's the affliction, then that's what you want to deal with, the affliction. And what better possible way to deal with the affliction is to go to that place of loving kindness, compassion, patience, understanding. You know, how it must feel to have a cough. You know how it must feel to know that it's bothering other people but not be able to stop it. So on and so forth. So there's a lot of room there for patience, understanding, compassion, and for getting to the root of your affliction, seeing if you can't make your affliction the focus of your attention. Accept it, let it lose its power, and in that way overcome it. So by all means, it's absolutely a wonderful thing to do. The snoring, same thing. I mean, have compassion for the person who's snoring, because after all, they're missing out on this good meditation time.
Could you talk a little bit, maybe later today, about purifications of memories, emotions, and pain at stage 4 and then afterwards?
Yes, we'll try to find some time to do that. Okay, we got 4 seconds left. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to see if I can finish up as many of these as I can. How can we be on the lookout for insight experiences? And if we do find one, how can we practice to help them become insights? Okay. The best way to recognize insight experiences is to know what you're looking for. So if you're doing the study part of the practice, you understand the goals of the practice. If you know the insights that, you know, then what's going to happen is you're going to have an insight experience and you're going to go, oh wow, this is impermanence. You know? And that's the kind of thing you want. Oh wow, there's no self in this moment. Ooh. That kind of thing. It helps so much to know what it is that you're looking for. The other thing is to meditate always with the idea that I'm open to whatever presents itself, whatever experience arises, I'm open to it, rather than always being focused on the goal. If you are focused on getting to the next stage, you are going to see every insight experience that presents itself as a problem that's interfering with your meditation, right? So the manifestation of impermanence says, hey, here I am, look at me. And you say, another darn distraction. So you're always open, welcoming, not judging, but being discerning at the same time. So something comes along and says, okay, I don't think you're an insight. Let it go, and I come back. But you're always open to the possibility that it might have been before you exercise that discernment, decide that it wasn't.
Yeah. Earlier in the retreat, during a Q&A, you said something about letting insight experiences just stay in your awareness and not necessarily focusing your attention on that.
Yes, I explained that. Let me explain that a little more fully. When an insight experience arises, don't jump on it full bore with attention and begin to analyze it. Because all of that conceptual thinking, I mean, you already had all those concepts. And what the insight is offering you is a deeper perspective that goes beyond the barrier of your concepts. So you don't want to dump a load of your concepts on top of the insight. So don't jump on it with attention. To the degree that you pay attention to it, it's not analytically, it's investigatively. It's just taking it in as fully as you can. There's inevitably going to be a certain amount of conceptualization. But try to limit that, you know. If you find the thought arising that, oh wow, now I see, this is emptiness in action. Now I see how my mind creates these projections. So let the thought go at that point. It's a good thought. Now just get into looking at how the mind creates its projections without analyzing it. It's a skill. Okay. And how to help them become insights. They become insights through continuing to hold them and letting the information that they are conveying penetrate to the deeper levels of your mind. And it becomes an insight when this is information that gets assimilated by those deeper levels of the mind and thereby changes the way you see reality. Then it's an insight. To further consolidate that insight, if you have an experience that's an insight experience, because it allows you to, you feel at one with everything, and it arouses within you a knowing that this is not just a feeling. In truth, there is no separation. The boundaries that my mind makes are illusory. So then you've got some insight there. Consolidate that. When you get up from your meditation, see that truth. Continue to see that truth over and over again in as many ways as you can. even after the feeling of oneness is gone. Because actually the feeling of oneness is kind of like a sign telling you where to look. And don't get attached to the feeling, because it will go away. But it drew your attention to something. And then reinforce that. Re-experience that. Bring home to yourself in as many ways as you can the truth of that. Where does creativity come from, and how is it related to karma? Creativity comes from the fact that you aren't a single, separate, isolated mind that thinks it's itself. And so the most creative things you've ever done have come from way beyond your petty self. How it relates to karma is, as you create the karma not to see yourself as so separate and isolated, your creativity will expand exponentially. Because you're taking down the barriers that the mind has created. I think this will be the last one, because I'm really pushing into your meditation time. Can you please say a little bit about how this practice progresses? I've gathered the 10 stages are for developing samatha, and that with samatha one may practice vipassana. How would that occur, and how do the jhanas fit into this model? Okay, this will be brief. The 10 stages are 10 stages of samatha and vipassana. When you develop samatha, you will experience insights, vipassana. So they're not separate things. The insights can come at any stage, inside within meditation or outside of meditation. The further you progress in the 10 stages, the more likely you are to have very powerful insight experiences, and the more likely you are to be able to recognize and appreciate them when they arise. But there's not a direct correlation. It would be, wouldn't really be true to say that insights really start to happen at stage X, you know, because it doesn't really work that way. There are practices that are called insight practices in vipassana. Basically the name wasn't owned by somebody else, so they sort of co-opted it. In those practices, generally, what they describe as the true beginning of insight in the 16 stages of the progress of insight that's based on the Mahasi-style noting practice. In that particular example, what they call the true beginning of insight really corresponds to about stage 7 and stage 8, samatha. You have to develop that degree of concentration before insight really begins in that system. But that's just a generalization about a particular system. Insights even within that system can very easily begin earlier. And there are some insights that do happen earlier even within that system. Insights can happen at any time. And you can zoom all the way through stage 10 without realizing you've ever had an insight experience. Especially if you're gung-ho to get there, right? Very goal-oriented, and so forth. So it could go either way. So think of it this way: you keep practicing samatha and vipassana. You keep advancing through the stages, knowing that the farther along you get, the more likely you are to have insight. Not only are the more likely you are to have insight, the more likely you are to have the culminating insight that results in awakening. Because that's the other thing. You can become enlightened at stage 1, samatha. And then, if you keep on going, you can become an arhat, or Buddha, or however you want to describe it. So you keep on going no matter what. It's not like, oh, I only had to do stage 1, here I am. Keep going, because there's more to do. But it can happen at any point. So that's how to think of the relationship between samatha and practice in the larger sense. How do the jhanas fit into this model? Instead of the model, let's say, how do the jhanas fit into the 10 stages? If you try to practice jhanas before stage 6, you are almost certainly going to find yourself hijacked by distractions and end up daydreaming, or else you're going to get really drowsy. So usually don't introduce jhana practice until stage 6 at the earlier. And from stage 6 on, you can practice gradually deepening forms of the jhana. There are very, very light forms of jhana. The experiencing the whole body with the breath in stage 6 is a perfect vehicle for entering into a very light jhana. There are deeper jhanas that you can access from higher stages of samatha. Stage 7 is a really good opportunity to start doing a kind of light jhana where you focus your attention on pleasure, on pleasure and joy, and enter the jhana that way. Beyond that point, you can practice jhanas that use illumination, an inner illumination that arises. Use that as the object. Any of you are familiar at all with Ajahn Brahmavamsa and the method of jhana that he teaches in Australia, or Pa'ok Sayadaw, who teaches jhanas in the... he's now got a center in California, but he teaches in Southeast Asia as well. They use the light, this illumination phenomena. The illumination typically arises, it can arise at earlier stages, but usually a person has that around stage 8. And so in stage 8, somebody could use that to enter jhanas. And then beyond that point, there's the deepest of all jhanas that use what's called the mental counterpart image of meditation object. You use the mental counterpart image of the breath to enter a very deep jhana where the mind's completely withdrawn from the senses. So that's how they fit structurally into the stage. Another way that they fit in is actually first, second, third, fourth jhana qualitatively correspond to stage 7, stage 8, stage 9, and stage 10, which is why would you practice jhanas? Well, if you practice jhanas, it accelerates your progress through these stages, because what you're doing, if you are in stage 6 and you practice you're practicing third jhana using the whole body jhana, the very light whole body jhana. What you're essentially doing is you're tricking your mind through the jhana into entering a state that corresponds to stage 9, which is going to accelerate your process through the latter stages. So that's a reason, that's a value of the jhanas in the samatha practice. But you'll notice there's an interesting reciprocal thing there, that being a stage 10 samatha practitioner is like being somebody who has all the attributes of fourth jhana, but without having to be in a state of absorption. That's powerful. Stage 9 samatha, it's like being in third jhana without being limited by the absorption. Absorption is a particular mental state. It's a groove your mind can make for itself and slip into. It's very powerful and it's very useful. The other way that jhanas fit in is jhanas are vipassana practice. They are the vipassana practice that the Buddha taught. They are the vipassana practice that's mentioned throughout the sutras. And they are very powerful vipassana practice. They are a powerful way to achieve insight. So that's the other way to use the jhanas, is to practice them as an insight practice, which involves developing very powerful metacognitive introspective awareness and carefully observing and comparing what it's like to be in access concentration before you enter a jhana, what it's like to be in the jhana, what it's like to come out of the jhana, and doing this over and over again for all the different jhanas. It's like dissecting the mind, and it yields very powerful insights. So that's how jhana fits in with jhana. Okay, that's enough for today. That's too much for today. We'll continue on this evening. So. Thank you very much. You have 31 minutes left, and have a good meditation.